Hello, listeners, book lovers, and friends. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Holly Payne, the host of Page One, a podcast that celebrates the stories and craft that go into writing the first sentence, first paragraph, and first page of a book. Now, all master storytellers will probably tell you that the first page is often their most rewritten page because it has to work so hard to achieve so much, hooking the reader, hooking you. And I'm excited to announce that today we're recording the 10th episode of the Page One podcast. Now, this probably doesn't sound like a big deal to most of you who listen to a lot of podcasts, but this is definitely a very humble milestone because most podcasts go to the grave after the first three episodes. So thank you for listening and spreading the word about Page One this year. I've had so much fun creating this podcast and interviewing authors, and I love diving into these conversations about storytelling and writing. And today, we have the honor of talking with best-selling author Jacqueline Mitchard about her latest novel, The Good Son, published by Mira, which is a division of HarperCollins, in January. Jacqueline Mitchard is the New York Times best-selling author of 22 novels for adults and teenagers and the recipient of Great Britain's Talk About Prize, the Bram Stoker and Shirley Jackson Awards, and named to the shortlist for the Women's Prize for Fiction. Her first novel, which you might have recalled or read or seen on the screen, is The Deep End of the Ocean, which was the inaugural selection of the Oprah Winfrey Book Club with more than 3 million copies in print in 34 languages. It was later adapted into the feature film starring Michelle Pfeiffer, and her novel Still Summer has also been adapted for a film still in production. Jacqueline has gifted us with a very wide range of writing, and her essay collection, The Rest of Us, Dispatches from the Mothership, was drawn from her newspaper columns syndicated by Tribune Media. And her other essays have been widely anthologized and published in magazines worldwide and incorporated into school curricula. She also served on the fiction jury for the 2003 National Book Awards and served as editor-in-chief of Merit Press, a young adult imprint under the aegis of Simon & Schuster. Now, a Chicago native, Mitchard grew up the daughter of a plumber and a hardware store clerk who met as rodeo riders. She is a distinguished fellow at the Ragdale Foundation and a DeWitt Clinton Reader's Digest Fellow at the McDowell Colony. Jacqueline has taught in the MFA programs for creative writing at Vermont College of Fine Arts, Miami University of Ohio, and Western New England University. She lives on Cape Cod with her husband and their 9 children. Jacqueline Mitchard, what a pleasure to talk to you. Welcome to Page One.
I'm delighted to be here. This is such a wonderful concept for a writerly podcast, isn't it?
Oh, well, thank you. I'm so excited to dive into this today. And I'm going to share your new book summary with our listeners because we avoid all spoilers on Page One. After all, we're here to discuss your first page. So here's the summary of this gripping new novel, The Good Son, the story of two women, one whose son was convicted of murdering the other's daughter. So talk about a dramatic irony. What do you do when the person you love best becomes unrecognizable to you? For Thea Demetrio, the answer is both simple and agonizing. You keep loving him somehow. Her son, Stefan, was just 17 when he went to prison for the drug-fueled murder of his girlfriend, Belinda. 3 years later, he's released to a world that refuses to let him move on. Belinda's mother, once Thea's good friend, galvanizes the community to rally against him to protest in her daughter's memory. The media paints Stefan as a symbol of white privilege and indifferent justice. Neighbors, employers, even some members of Thea's own family turn away. Meanwhile, Thea struggles to understand her son, and at times he is still the sweet boy he has always been, and at others, he's a young man tormented by guilt and almost broken by his time in prison. But as his efforts to make amends meet escalating resistance and threats, Thea suspects more forces are at play than just community outrage. And if there is so much she never knew about her own son, what other secrets has she yet to uncover, especially about the night Belinda died? That is a great summary, and you raised so many questions in it. Jacqueline, will you please read from the first page of The Good Son?
I'd be happy to.
Great.
I was picking my son up at the prison gates when I spotted the mother of the girl he had murdered. two independent clauses, 10 words each, joined by an adverb, made up entirely of words that once would have been unimaginable to think, much less to say. She pulled in, not next to me, but four spaces over, in the half circle of 15-minute spots directly in front of the main building. It was not where Stefan would walk out. That would be over at the gatehouse. She got out of her car, and for a moment, I thought that she would come toward me. I wanted to talk to her. I wanted to offer something, to reach out and hold her, for we had not been able even to attend Belinda's funeral. But what would I say? What would she? This was an unwanted crease in an already unaccustomed day. I slid deep into my own down coat and wished I could lock the car doors, although I feared that the sound would crack the pre-dawn darkness like a rifle shot. All that Jill McCormick did, however, was to shove her hands into the pockets of her jacket and lean back against the bumper of her car. She wore the heavy maroon varsity leather jacket that her daughter Belinda, captain of the high school cheer team in senior year, had given to her, to Stefan, and to me, with our names embroidered in gold on the back, just like hers was. I hadn't seen Jill McCormick up close for years, though she lived literally around the corner. Once I used to stop there to sit on her porch, but now I avoided even driving past.
That is so powerful. Your opening sentence there, I was picking up my son at the prison gates when I spotted the mother of the girl he had murdered. That in and of itself is such an incredible first sentence. How far into your writing did this line come to you, or was it one of those gifts that just happened?
It was neither. I never write a second sentence of a book until I have a first sentence. And I can labor over that first sentence for weeks or months until it's perfect. And it has to be, in some ways, comprise a promise to the reader of what's to come, so that the reader will look back on it and say, oh, now I understand why that was so important, or why that revealed to me something I didn't understand that I already knew at that point. Because first pages, first sentences, and first paragraphs, the good ones, are all like that. They comprise everything that's going to come later in the book, although the reader doesn't know that at the time. And it isn't until completing the book that you have that delicious sense that it was all there all along.
Yeah, it's almost like, I love that phrase, the delicious sense that it was all there all along. Because I think for listeners who are aspiring, or they're in the middle of a work, hearing someone like you describe this process and that you labor over it, I want to get into that a little more. I want to kind of peel that back from your perspective, because when I used to teach, and I know you taught too, I think one of the greatest challenges for most writers is they're trying to be clever. I want to talk about what it means for you to labor over these without it, quote unquote, appearing clever. But when you get to that end and you go back and you read the first sentence, second sentence, you know, first paragraph, and you realize, oh my gosh, it was there all along. That's the kind of clever that you want, right?
The important thing in starting a book, and it's counterintuitive, okay, is for writers to know, is to dive right in, dive right into the action. Don't tell the reader any background. The reader will learn the background when the reader needs to learn it, and will learn it within context. The most important thing that I have to correct sometimes in the fiction of new writers is that they want to have this whole backgrounding thing in the first paragraphs, where the person came from and where grandparents came from. And none of that matters. To the reader wants to know what's happening in the kitchen right now.
In these paragraphs, you're giving us just enough. There's little hints about the relationship with the mom of the girl who was killed. There's so much you give us in that one sentence. We know that these kids were high school kids. We know that there's obviously a relationship. You don't just give a jacket like this to anyone. So that sentence is actually doing a lot of heavy lifting, and it's informing us and giving us only enough information that we need right there without boring us to tears and taking us off topic by telling us about the birth scene, right?
Right. It could have said, I remembered then how they looked in their prom clothes and that they, when they went to the eighth grade formal and they were high school sweethearts, everything is comprised by the fact that she gave the three most important people in her life that jacket with an implicit knowledge of their past together and a presumption of their future together.
And that is incredible craft right there. It's just getting us the information that we need because you're setting up very specific things here. And I want to get back to the comment you made about promises. It seems that every master storyteller, you included, really walks around understanding this promise. And it's almost as if that's your responsibility to fulfill that promise. So you're not only setting it up, but you also have to fulfill it. So will you talk to us a little bit about the promise that's in this book in terms of what you're setting up in these specific opening sentences and opening paragraphs?
The promise here is that I am going to, as a storyteller, let you know how the unthinkable happened in this seemingly ordinary, normal, and functional group of people. Because there are two things that are at play here. One is she's picking up her son at the gates of the prison after he did time for murder. The other thing is she's reflecting that the other mother, the mother of the murdered girl, is wearing the varsity jacket that's still new enough to wear because her daughter only graduated high school a couple of years ago and didn't survive her senior year in college. So the seemingly normal and the driving past someone's house, going on your walk and sitting on the porch and talking to the person, to now being someone who's afraid to even look into the person's eyes, I hope the reader would react to this by wanting to know, how did this happen?
Yeah.
How did we get to this place of such extremes from a seemingly bucolic and idyllic relationship in an ordinary neighborhood in anywhere town?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is, the promise is just incredible. The strength of that first sentence, I was picking up my son at the prison gates when I spotted the mother of the girl he had murdered. If that just doesn't hook you in terms of raising those very questions of how did that happen? And the irony of why would she show up there? And then the next sentence, and I couldn't help but just love this. Two independent clauses, 10 words each, joined by an adverb, made up entirely of words that would have once been unimaginable to think, much less say. And can you talk to me a little bit about that? Because we know, you told me what Theo does. So again, I'm trying not to give anything away to listeners who haven't read it yet, but we can say that she's a literature professor.
Right. She's a literature professor and thinks carefully about language all the time. Even throughout the book, she thinks about what people are saying, but also what people mean underneath what they're saying. And that becomes a part of her obsession, that she's thinking about what is said and what seems to be true versus what is unsaid and needs to be discovered to find out what was really true.
And the other thing that is going on here, that's very, very subtle, but it's very clear in terms of your skill, is you're clearly setting up your point of view character, Thea's compassion. Even when you read it, Jackie, I could feel it. It was coming out of your voice. You say, I wanted to talk to her, to offer something, to reach out and hold her. For anyone who's ever experienced something just absolutely horrific like this, where it is the unimaginable, for you to put yourself in that place is an extraordinary feat because you're taking on so much here in terms of the other perspective. What you're carefully setting up is that her heart's always been open to this woman.
Her heart has always been open to both guilt and identification, because both of them have lost something. The one woman obviously has lost her child forever. The other mother, the mother of the presumed murderer, has lost her child's future and his past and all the innocence and the things that she believed were possible for raising her only child. So in a sense, there is a sort of horrible covenant between these two women, where there once existed a healthy and productive relationship between two women, is now this star-crossed or tragedy-crossed relationship. And I think Thea would love what she's really searching for by offering compassion, I think, is a kind of forgiveness for herself.
Yeah.
She's asking forgiveness. Please understand that it's not my fault that this happened. Please right. understand that I was not an evil mother, that I didn't do wrong. Because one of the things that comes forth in this book over and over is that in situations like this, the parents are always called to task. It is always believed that none of this would have happened if they had been better parents. What could I have done differently? She believes that she has been raised to believe that there are answers to most questions. She has been raised to believe that as a teacher and as a student, she's been raised to believe that there are very few things in the world that cannot be addressed by logic. And this is one. She's trying to describe this situation in when she uses the parts of speech. She's thrust into a universe that she has no way of understanding.
You pair both of them with this deep loss that you've just described so well. And it's just masterful in terms of all the elements that you're able to get into. I don't know how many words are here. Wait, less than 500, 300 words. Will you tell us a little bit about that craft and your discipline to eliminate all other options?
One of the important lessons that I learned as a writer, and I didn't for until my graduate studies, I really didn't take any courses in writing except for the freshman composition elective at the University of Illinois. But what I learned from the University of Good Books, if you will, from reading the books that I admire most and reading about the people who wrote them, is that economy of language, taking out every word that you can take out to the point of pain, is so important for good prose. And I learned that especially from Truman Capote, from reading In Cold Blood. He's a masterful writer and one of the several writers after whom I like to think that I would try to pattern my own prose, that everything that is inessential has to go. And then what's left is only deceptively simple. It's simple, but it's not easy. It's simple, but it's profound, where you can spend half a page with all kinds of turgid language and explaining things this way and that way and up and down and sideways. But if you can find a simple way to say it, but still imbue it with all that power and meaning, that's what you want to try to do as a writer.
That's the game. We have 26 letters that we have at our disposal, and that deftness of what you just explained, the process, the endeavor, it's an endeavor in reduction. A great editor will know that. That's what their job is to do, is to take everything away. And then, you know, often the author who's not used to that goes, oh my God, only half of it's left. But isn't that how Michelangelo found David? He just chipped away at a stone and that sculpture emerged. If Truman Capote was such an influence on you, how early were you starting to read that? And is it something that you still go back to remind yourself of that discipline?
I just did the other day. I just read In Cold Blood probably for the fifth time just the other day, because I was thinking about great first sentences in preparation for talking to you and reading the first sentence of that book. Then I was drawn into the first page, and then I was drawn into the first chapter, and then I was lost again in reading this story. as if, of course, I knew what happened. But then again, I knew what happened when I first read it, because everybody knew that it wasn't a story about kinds of things that you do at the beach. You knew it was a story of unimaginable tragedy. I was reading it for the first time as a high school girl. Then I read it as a teacher. Then I assigned it to my students so that they could study as writers the deceptive simplicity of the way that he put his sentences and paragraphs and ultimately stories together, not just that book, but other books as well, his short stories and Breakfast at Tiffany's and other books that didn't have the gravitas or impact of that book. He worked so hard. I mean, though he was a natural, I don't think of myself as a natural, but he was, and writing stories from a very young age, still he worked very hard on taking everything out that he could. And there are many writers who, if you interview them, will talk about that process of having the essential, just the essential sentence.
You just said something that really struck me as curious. You said, he's a natural, but you're not a natural. So unpack that for me. What does that mean to you?
It means that some writers, there are kinds of writers who are organic, and then there are kinds of writers who are structuralists. And I am the latter. I plan everything rigorously. I know exactly what will come after that morning in the park and then the day at the restaurant. And when she meets the priest, I know exactly what will come after the thing before I ever write it. Mm-hmm. I have essentially not an outline, but a sort of narrative outline of the plan, maybe 20 pages of what will happen next and what will happen after that. I write from the beginning to the end. I write from the beginning to the end, and that which comes before has to be completed before I go on to the next thing. Most writers write a whole draft, and then they go back into it to see how it actually should fit together. And once they have the basics down in this huge rush of getting the information out and drafting it, I can't imagine doing that. To me, it's like building a house. Yeah. You wouldn't go over there and just say, okay, let's get this down. You know, we'll throw the walls up and then we'll put a little carpeting in it. And to me, every brick has to be dependent on the brick that came before. But you build it slowly in that way, though it's painstaking and often frustrating to do it in that way because you want to leap ahead.
I don't know if you could do it the other way because it's all cause and effect. If you're doing that, how are your transitions?
It's painstaking, but it's not painful because I know how to do it. Over many years of trial and error, I learned how to do it, which is that there should be a scene and then you have a period of reflection in the prose, a period in which someone has a cup of coffee and a piece of apple cake and walks over to the window and sees that there's a duck crossing the yard, because the reader needs time to absorb and assimilate into their very molecules the action that came before and what it's going to mean to the action that comes afterwards. So you're writing in scenes and segues, and the segues are just as important as the scenes. The segues are the place in which the greatest understanding and reflection takes place for the reader.
You're listening to the Page One podcast that celebrates the first sentence, first paragraph, and first page of a book. I'm Holly Payne, your host and producer, and I interview master storytellers about the struggles and stories that go into writing the first page of their books. As the author of four novels and a writing coach, I know that the first page of any book has to work so hard to do so much, hook the reader. So I thought to ask your favorite master storytellers how they do their magic to hook you. I started the podcast this past spring, and after the first few episodes, it occurred to me that maybe someone listening might be curious about how their first page sits with an audience. Writing takes courage, and courage needs a community. So I'm opening up the podcast to any writer who wants to submit the first page of a book they're currently writing. If your page is chosen, you'll be invited onto the show to read it and get live feedback from one of Page One's master storytellers. I'm so excited about this. I love when there's a chance for a new author to get discovered, and Page One exists to inspire, celebrate, and promote the work of both a known and unknown creative talent. Maybe that's you. If this excites you, please submit your page at hollylynnpayne.com/community. That's Holly Lynn Payne, HollyLynnPayne.com/community. And now back to the show. So what is your discipline on this, the length of the segues?
They're about the same length. I would say that a scene might be a page, 6 paragraphs. The segue to the next scene might be just a little less, 4 or 5 paragraphs and something less than a page. And it's the breath in, the breath out. It's just like you did at the beginning of this podcast. It's thinking about what just happened and what does that mean?
I love the way that you just described it. It reminds me of, you know, the old stereo, you know, systems where we could see the song, like it was an equalizer. It would build. And I often thought, wow, that's almost like you could use a song and create a narrative. Because if you're looking at that in a rise and fall, it's just like song composition in the way that you're describing this.
It's more like song composition than anyone can possibly imagine. If you think of the song, and I often use the song just because it's my favorite song, Clair de Lune, Debussy's Clair de Lune. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And when it starts, it's a straightforward statement of the melody, the main theme. And then throughout the rest of the short symphony, it builds and it builds and it's more complicated with other themes coming in. And until it gets to a point in the crescendo when it's so unbearably beautiful, you don't think that you can listen to any more, that you'll just die if you listen to any more of it. Okay. Yes, and then it starts to drop off. And by the end, you're back to the original innocent statement of what was there. And that's the way a novel works. That's exactly the way it works, like a composition. So that when you come back to the end, you discover what the beginning meant.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. If anyone wants to study this, please study The Good Son and what Jackie is describing, because it really, really fulfills this in terms of craft. And that very first sentence is really setting up the melody, right? The whole play between the protagonist and the antagonist is set up in the first sentence. And then we unpack it. And then there's all the complications. And the complications are because of the nuance of these relationships, the shifting relationship structures within this story based on this whole situation.
But also the shifting understanding of what no one understands at the beginning, what actually happened. The facts of the story change. What Thea thinks she understands at the beginning is not anything to what she really understands when she finally finds out the truth, if you will. But in her reflection at the end of the book, and again, this is not giving anything away, it's then that she also understands what Jill had to teach her and what you learn through the dangerous empathy with someone who has been both sinned against and sinning.
That's a great phrase, the dangerous empathy. It really is. That is perfect in terms of what is happening here and what you go through as an author. The dangerous empathy.
Yeah, you don't. I mean, do you think that when I first proposed writing this book, my agent was speechless and he said, that's all well and good, but you could never make these people sympathetic. You could never make anyone care about them. I don't even know that you would want to go inside of the person who knew that kind of stuff. But that's our task,
right? That's
as a writer, is to go into places that frighten you and where you just don't want to go and find that compassion and that empathy. Look at, again, you know, without beating Truman Capote too much, though he wouldn't mind at all, I'm sure, it is when he had to go into the minds of people who were cold-blooded killers and find in them some kind of compassion for the suffering that led to the suffering that they caused.
Right.
It's difficult to go into those wastelands of human character. And yet it's there, I think, sometimes that we find the most writerly profit for the work that we're going to do.
and the courage, right, to just stand up for what you knew could happen, because the entire act of writing this book and the entire act of writing in general, if you're really doing this and you're really rendering the human condition in all its authenticity, no one is without its flaws. No one lives without their darkness. We have our light and our shadows. And that is the contrast and the beauty and what gives you as an author all of the nuance to create this incredible tapestry, this depth of humanity. And so I'm curious, how did you manage that, the pushback? And did you just boldly go forward and say, I'm going to do this because I know I can?
No, because you don't do that with my agent. he said, show me a piece of writing in which it is evident that there's a way into these characters that won't be appalling and offensive to a reader. And so I did. I did some of the scenes. I wrote some of the things in the early part of the book. And then he saw it and he said, I'll never forget this. He said, you love people who no one can imagine you loving.
That is powerful.
And if you can do that, it isn't as though I love everybody or any of that kind of stuff. But once I am connected to a character, and once I am connected to that character's fate, I need to take the reader with me and say, here's why you should invest in following this person throughout all these pages. This is what you'll be rewarded with.
You say the word fate and then faith, and it slipped in there. That is curious to me, because as an author, you're taking on these characters, you're taking on something that you're looking at the underside. It's like, if you don't want to look at the darkness in life, maybe you shouldn't be writing. It's about investigating the nuances of life. And by your ability to take on these characters and connect with their deepest core wounding, and as an author, to go deep into the psyche and the heart of these people, where you realize no one's just a criminal. There's incredible humanity, and you just bring that out here where you can't ignore it.
And also, Thea, she says plainly that nothing in her life up to the point that this happened with her, that her son was convicted of voluntary manslaughter, nothing in her life up to that point had prepared her for anything except what she calls moderate good fortune. You know, she had good hair, she had a reasonable job, she had a husband she loved, she enjoyed good health, she loved her sisters and her parents. And then suddenly she was plunged into this abyss of doubt and fear and blackness and darkness that she never would have imagined, and plunged into it entirely without preparation. And in one of the essays I wrote about this book, I talked with a woman who had a son in prison. She wondered whether it was more difficult for people who had grown up in what you would call a normal environment without crime, without that kind of strain, or easier for people to visit their sons in prison, where prison was the place where you saw many people that you may have known.
I read about the inspiration for this book came from actually meeting a woman in a coffee shop. Can you talk about that? If you haven't been talking about it ad nauseum already.
Now, I'll never be tired of this story. This was one of the most powerful things that ever happened to me. I was at a big writers' conference and I was going to speak pretty soon. And I went down to get my coffee in the hotel, and she was in the line in front of me. She dropped her book on the floor and I picked it up and handed it to her and blithely said, oh, are you here for the conference? No, she said, I'm here to see my son. I come every weekend and I stay overnight at this hotel because he's in prison nearby. And I was brushed back in the sense that, and this is really selfish, I knew I was going to give a speech to 1,000 people in a few minutes. And I thought, don't tell me what happened. But she did. And she said that he had killed the only girl he ever loved. And he was so messed up on drugs that he had no memory of the crime. And that further, she, the mother of the murderer, had gone to put flowers on the girl's grave. And when she was there, the mother came. The girl's mother showed up at the cemetery. And the woman was terrified. But as it transpired, they just fell into each other's arms, crying. Yeah. And the mother of the murdered girl said, at least you can still touch him. And the fact that he's alive means that there, at length, there may be some hope. And she had to agree that despite the agony that she went through, she was actually luckier. And again, that's like talking about, did you lose your leg or did you only break it? You know, it's a terrible calculus. That story stayed with me for years. And it was only when I was unable to make two other books work for me, which had been, that never happened in my experience before, but I had two good ideas for books and they both just flamed out after hundreds of pages of writing. Then I turned to this story and proposed it. And it turned out to be the story that I'm proudest of all the books I've written.
Thinking about this moment, you know, you're about to go speak in front of all these people at a writer's conference. Did it cross you as, is this my next book?
No.
Okay. No,
absolutely not. In fact, up until the moment I started to discover the characters and think about the characters and the story as I would write it, I thought, that's too sad. I'm not going anywhere near that.
Yeah.
Because it's a story about a sad thing that only gets sadder. And I thought, why would I want to do that? I mean, people already think that I am the queen of tragedy and I should just stay away from it. But at the end of the day, because as writers, we are able to tinker with history, you know, we don't have to stick to the facts. Fiction writers don't have to stick to the facts. We are able to look at what might have happened or what could have happened along with what actually did happen. So I had the power to tell the story, but also to add to the story in a way that the original story didn't comprise. And I think of that sort of as a letter to that mother.
Yeah, well, and also your own life, your loss of your husband early on with three young boys. I think you said you had a 9-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 3-year-old. Mm-hmm. Clearly, that loss and tragedy, when you came to look at this story as a possibility and where you took it with the license that you have as a novelist, how much of your own life and your understanding of crawling out of that pit of despair is a part of Thea's arc?
Well, early on, you know, even during the time when The Deep End of the Ocean was being published, many reviewers and also the publisher of that book said, you have an authority of grief. You are someone who writes about grief with the knowledge of a survivor in the most classic sense of someone who didn't just live through the hard time and come out on the other side, but built something out of it. Suffering will come to us all, okay? But unless you do it, as Dashiell Hammett said, unless you do it really well, it's only blunt pain. You have to interpret it and make of it something that on a cloudy day might pass for art.
Talk about, you know, a compost pile. Right? Mm-hmm. I mean, really rich material. And
nourishing material comes out of that, of the things that we leave behind or try to leave behind.
Yeah. And so when you showed the pages to your agent and he said, okay, I see this, right? Was that...
He didn't say that. He said, okay, how are we ever going to sell this? And he was right, because it was like my great friend, Lisa Genova, when she wrote the book, Still Alice, you know, she said she would describe it to people and be about a Harvard professor in her 50s who got Alzheimer's and is slowly losing her mind and her memory, you know, while raising her young adult children. And she said, and people said, and okay, why do we even want to know about this? And some of the same things pertained to this story. Why do we want to know about this darkness? Why do we want to know about not just bad things happen to good people, but what about when good people cause bad things to happen?
The reason why, I think, is because we need a companion in the darkness, right? We need a map to navigate the loss, even if it's someone else's. That's what great literature does. A great story will say, this is their situation, this is how they dealt with it. And, you know, all of us coming off of the pandemic, right? The last year and a half, 2 years has been one wild roller coaster for every person on the planet. And I think for anyone who's never experienced the kind of loss that you have, or was forced because of a circumstance to be a survivor of something, it thrust everyone into a collective trauma. And the world is different now. It's almost like perfect timing for The Good Son to come out, because people can wrap their heads around this, because we need help. We need a flashlight to get through the darkness, you know?
And sometimes I think that my mentor was a science fiction writer, okay? He was the greatest of all science fiction writers, Ray Bradbury.
Who was that? Okay. Ray Bradbury. Wow.
Yeah. And we were friends for 30 years. He would say to me, and this is wisdom that I've carried with me all my life, that The Martian Chronicles was not really about Mars. It was about people. And all the stories that he wrote about, they were really all about the relationships between people. And the rest of it is sort of the coach in which the story shows up. And the rest of it is the dressing that the story is wearing. But really, at the end of the day, all stories are about how, whether we like it or not, we're connected to each other.
Absolutely. That's the reason why we read. That's brilliant. I love that he boiled it down to every story is about a person. If we can back up a second, you mentioned before that this outlining or loose outlining that you do is slightly painful, if not very painful.
Yes.
And even though it's painful, can you describe that pain and how you deal with it? Because most people don't really quite understand this pain unless they've actually been in the trenches of trying to write a novel and piece a story together.
You are an endurance athlete, and you know how the pain that you go through leads to the exhilaration that you feel once you finally nail the thing that you set yourself up to do. But when I start to work my way into a story and I don't know what's going to come next, and I don't know how the twists and turns of the story are going to manifest themselves, and I don't know what the people want, what I'm going to cause them to want, I just think I could do this, or I could just lie on my back and eat Doritos. And I would rather do that than follow this story to the place that I know that when I get there, I will have something that I can sink myself into and feel with every fiber of my writerly self. But would I rather not do it? Yeah, I'd rather not do it. I'd rather not do it at all.
We should just send you some bags of Doritos.
I think that I would rather have a book that only had one word in it, and there would be an 800 number or 900 number. And then people would call me and I could say, could I charge you $15? And I'll just tell you the story and you're really going to like it. Because all the craft and the, it's really is like breaking stone. It really is like chipping away and making mistakes and having to start over. It's extremely painstaking. And as a writer, you know that writing is one of those things that people imagine that you just sit down and you have a bonbon and a beer and you just write that little thing and it's so easy and you get it done in a couple of weeks and then they give you a lot of money when in fact it's really difficult. It's really difficult and it's demanding of every ounce of skill that you have.
And not only that, it's demanding that you're inhabiting this world at a cellular level. You mentioned it before when you're talking about these characters. And there's a friction, right? The cognitive load of doing that day in and day out and being, it's almost like being a method actor, but you're not just taking on one role, you're taking on all the roles that are in the story. It's a huge energy exchange. But when you reach that kind of summit or you cross the finish line and it, whether it's the finish line of a scene or a sequence, what's that like for you?
I don't feel euphoria, but I feel relief.
Yeah.
And the relief is this, okay? When I'm able to get you to hear the same song that I hear. And so then I don't have to be alone with it. And so this is, I mean, when Emily said, this is my letter to the world that never wrote to me, she's talking about the way that you feel as a writer when you've caused someone to take your hand and to experience what you're experiencing, that communion. And nobody really, people say all the time, oh, I just write for me. I don't care what, you know, if anybody reads it, and I don't care what the critic, of course you do, you big liar. You know, you care what, you care very much that someone is out there who hears you and who shares that cry of the heart that you have labored to bring into being. In fact, you wouldn't do it if it wasn't for the reader.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other thing that you, as a master storyteller, know, you're always writing to serve the reader. You're always having them in mind, you know, in terms of how they're going to experience something. And you mentioned something that, you know, I want to thank you as a reader as well, and a writer. You know, you have taken our hand in this way, and you've led us into what is seemingly, it's deceptive, feels like it's really dark. But what you do is you bring us into the light of compassion, because you help us feel and break our hearts open and feel for this family, this mother and her son, in a way that might help us look at other events that are happening right now and unfolding in the world with a new perspective. And that's a really powerful thing that you are doing in the story and as a writer, is really helping us to be a little more compassionate.
We're asking, writers always ask, you know, if you take my hand, you can trust me. I won't let you fall. You're going to feel afraid, and sometimes you're going to feel appalled, and sometimes you're going to want to turn back, but I promise I won't let you fall.
Yeah.
And if you follow me, and you'll be better for it. And that's a huge risk that a reader takes.
Would you share a first paragraph of something that you're currently reading that is just really working for you?
Yes. And this was published a few years ago, but by a writer whom I love as a human being and as a writer. I would read anything that she wrote forever. And her name is Curtis Sittenfield. She wrote Prep. And this opening paragraph is from a book called The Man of My Dreams. Julia Roberts is getting married. It's true. Her dress will be an $8,000 custom-made two-piece gown from the Tyler Trafficante West Hollywood Salon. And at the reception following the ceremony, she'll be able to pull off the train and the long part of the skirt in order to dance. The bridesmaid dresses will be seafoam green, and their shoes, Manolo Blahnik, $425 a pair, will be dyed to match. The bridesmaids themselves will be Julia's agents. She has two. Her makeup artist, and a friend who's also an actress, though no one has ever heard of her. The cake will be four-tiered with violets and seafoam ribbons of icing. And that's the first paragraph. And it's especially, it's so filled with energy and snarkiness and description and adoration and all those things that you really understand who the speaker is right out of the gate, who the person is who's saying this. It's true. And, but also you have to realize that in history, when you look back on that, she never married that guy. All that seafoam and all those dresses and Blahnik shoes. And she never married that guy. So this book is wonderful. And part of the reason that I love it so much is that it has a premise that you wouldn't think would be a great book. It's about a girl growing up who's really lonely and how she peoples her life with these fantasies. I'm going to read you two all-time favorite first sentences.
Oh, okay. Great. Okay. I love this.
And they are both my favorite book. I mean, I have two favorite books and these are both of them. One of them is In Cold Blood that we talked about. And the first sentence is this: the village of Holcomb stands on the high wheat plains of Western Kansas, a lonesome area that other Kansans call out there. Okay. And that's a story. What happens out there in that lonesome place? Okay. Yeah. Something terrible. And you can tell that from that first line.
Or you can feel like the,
you
the
can feel the menace. You can feel that something's approaching. And this is from my other favorite book, which was an old book also called A Tree Grows in Brooklyn by Betty Smith. And this is the beautiful first paragraph. There's a tree that grows in Brooklyn. Some people call it the tree of heaven. No matter where its seed falls, it makes a tree which struggles to reach the sky. It grows in boarded up lots and out of neglected rubbish heaps. It grows up out of cellar gratings. It is the only tree that grows out of cement. It grows lushly, survives without sun, water, and seemingly without earth. It would be considered beautiful, except that there are too many of it.
So beautiful.
That book, it was so meaningful to me that I named my firstborn daughter Francie Nolan.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's great. I could sit here, Jackie, and talk to you for a lot longer because this has been so fun and you've been so generous with your time and insights. Before we say goodbye, I'm curious if there's one thing that you wish you had known, if there's someone that's listening who is an aspiring author, what would you say to someone who wants to start and go down this path?
I would say be patient with your story because people are in such a hurry to make it and to get the story out to the public. And they're encouraged because they're encouraged in that headlong approach to writing and publishing because everything is new for 5 minutes now. And then something else is new for five other minutes. But I would encourage each of them to be patient with their story, to stop in it and realize, is this a place for reflection? Is this a place for description? Be patient with the narrative. And at the end of it, you'll be grateful. And when the reader finally takes your hand, that reader will be grateful to you for being patient.
Well, we are all excited that we are going to take your hand and you're going to take ours because The Good Son is a perfect opportunity to experience what that means and a promise fulfilled by just a masterful storyteller.
Thank you so much for your kindness and having me on.
You've been listening to Page One, a podcast that celebrates the first sentence, first paragraph, and first page of a book. I'm the host and producer, Holly Payne, and I interview master storytellers about the struggles and stories that go into writing the first page of their latest book. If you're an aspiring writer or a book lover curious about how stories are made, the Page One podcast offers inspiration, wisdom, and some tips of the trade from the world's greatest authors. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I can't wait for you to tune into the next one. If you like Page One, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Pandora, Spotify, or any of your favorite podcast players. And please share this episode with your friends and family. Until then, keep writing. The world needs your stories. And keep reading. Books are medicine for the soul. I hope Page One helps you discover something you'll love too. If you want to learn more about my writing coaching or books, you can find me at hollylynnpayne.com. or on Twitter and Instagram at Holly Lynn Payne. That's HollyLynnPayne, hollylynnpayne.com. Thank you.